wonder-working power in the precious...
Incredible as they seem, are not the results of mass hysteria.
You may wish to adjust the dial you're currently tuned into.
The wrong station. I never thought of myself as the kind of person who wanted to make art that felt important. Or, more accurately, I guess, I never felt like I needed to make that kind of art. It'd be nice, of course, to have people think of your work as cerebral and fresh, stuff that pushes boundaries. You know, important. But I didn't need that. And besides, it's not exactly a reasonable expectation for an actor. Unless you're one of those actor, writer, producer types. You know the ones. People who will make their living touring a one-person show on the fringe circuit and who style themselves as a theater creator in their bio in the program. And power to them. But that was never me. No, just a simple, no extra frills actor. A song and dance man, as it turned out. Not that that was my specific aim when I went to school. I mean, I always thought my Chekhov was pretty good. But sometimes contracts just roll into contracts, and what starts with booking a nice feature role in a production of Annie ends with you being someone who owns jazz shoes and a vocal steamer. Which I was all fine with. I was. Though, even if you don't feel that need to do something groundbreaking with your life, a person still has aspirations. Ones that aren't necessarily fulfilled by doing a casino tour of a 50s jukebox show. Summer Nights, the show was called, though it was actually March when we put the thing up. Funny, those casino contracts. Almost a microcosm of this whole career, where you constantly oscillate between being treated like the scum of the earth and royalty. You work your ass off for 2 weeks straight, trying to cram 20 songs and 20 pieces of choreo into your head, below minimum wage while you're on the clock, not counting the fact that you're reviewing this stuff the second you get home, waking up in a panic twice a night. Then you get to the casino and you're the talent. Meal card, soft bed, expenses paid. Then you're back on the bus, sleeping on the bus, waking up with your neck at a 90-degree angle to do another tech load, and somebody's telling you to do a backflip and eat fire at 7:30 a.m. And repeat, and repeat. Again, fine for some. They thrive in it. For me, fine, but exhausting. Exhausting and, frankly, boring. Boring because the story of Sarah Jenkins Fleming meeting Alex Cool Slidell down at the old malt shop and showing him that that old rock and roll ain't so bad after all wasn't all that gripping to me. And boring because, despite doing two of those a day, there was still an abundance of free time. Lots of free time to sit with your own thoughts, if you enjoy that kind of thing. I don't at the best of times, and I certainly didn't then. Which is why I went for a walk one chilly afternoon, out of town and out onto the side roads, having no idea what I would stumble upon and how it would come to change me. You see, the thing about casinos is that if you've seen one, you've seen most. And the same goes for casino towns. We're not talking about Las Vegas here. We're talking places like Niagara Falls, Ontario. And that's one of the bigger examples. They're small, they're sad, there's not a lot of work, and there's not much to do but gamble. Or if you're somebody who has a casino subscription package, see a Tire Jukebox Musical. Which is why I took to walking in my own time, getting as far away as I could with enough time to make it back for shows. not breathe in stifled hotel air for just a few hours, and to try and see a tree. Or a shrub, at least. Dry brown shrubs that day, and dirt, and beaten asphalt and gravel, and the suggestion of a railing off the shoulder. And a couple hundred yards off into the hazy distance, a tent. One of those canopy types, a white, rust-spotted metal frame that stretched up and out to about 10 by 10 square feet, and a dusty, once-white canvas covering overhead. There was a crowd gathered underneath, their backs to the road. Around what, I couldn't tell just yet. As I got close, I saw a man seated in front of that crowd on the road shoulder, his back turned to them, facing the direction I was coming from. 40s, 50s, though I'd believe you if you told me he was 35. Thinning hair, rough stubble, faded slacks and a well-worn chambray shirt. Broad shoulders and strong-looking hands, though with a distinctly anterior crook to his posture. A man I'd never seen before, but whose type I'd seen in towns all over the province. Held tightly in his hands was an old strongbox. As I came up upon him and the crowded tent, he gave me a good up and down and said, 10 minimum. 10 minimum, I thought. For what? But before the words came out of my mouth, I stopped myself. Looking at him again, I reasoned that the man wasn't much for conversation. And I could have just kept walking. Make my way back to the hotel and let that little tent be something you wonder about once or twice a year. But call it curiosity, call it boredom, call it something cosmic, compelling, sinister. Without giving it too much more thought, I reached into my wallet and handed the man a sleek, purple plastic 10. He took the bill, then pulled a small yellow notepad from his chest pocket and scribbled something in pencil. Bid me pass with a shrug of the shoulder as he did. Now I was making my way through that crowd of 25, maybe 30. Most the same type as the man in the chair. White, wind-scarred faces past their prime. A few older than that. A few indigenous, East Asian, Southwest Asian. One, a Filipino woman who looked to be in her 80s, leaning on a walker. All quiet. All eyes forward. When I got to the front, I finally saw him. Another face like the man in the chair. Not just in type, though, but in intimate feature, give or take 5 extra years. A brother, probably. A cousin, at least. Same sun-beaten clothes and world-beaten back. But at that moment, he was standing tall. Quietly, with gravity, showing the crowd an object held supinated between thumb and index and middle finger. It was a pool ball, the 8. Holding it in front of him, he looked from one end of his audience to the other, taking a moment to meet the eyes of each person in turn. Even me. His gray-brown eyes looked into mine, and it's hard to fully describe what I felt right then, but certainly a profound sentiment, like a secret was being shared with me, like I was witness to something important. Then, after he'd finished his signifying, he shuffled his feet and moved into profile with us. My gut tightened. He tilted his head back. My heart was starting to race, and I did not know why, and opened his mouth wide. I could feel electricity in the air. Though the exact bodily mechanics were hidden from view, there was an implicit lowering of the tongue, raising of the palate, opening of the throat. And the 8-ball was gone. Eternity hung in the air. My eyes darted on their own to the rest of the crowd. If I could have controlled them, I wouldn't have been missing a moment of this. Everyone was silent. Everyone kept eyes front. My gaze returned to that performance. A performance? Yes, for no particular reason that I can point to, I decided that's what this must have been. The eight was still in his throat. You could see it bulging. His chin still high, his hand loose and limber at the ready. The bulge wiggled deliberately up and down an inch once, twice, and then, with a speed that conveyed perfect control and with the most barely perceptible gagging sound, it was up and out and again held gingerly between those three digits. He did not bow. The people did not clap. He simply nodded to them, and most of those gathered nodded back. A knowing look in all their eyes. And as for me, well, I didn't want to say that I was floored by what I'd just seen. I'd witnessed similar roadside distractions and freak shows here and there. Dogs jumping through hoops, fortune tellers, little curiosity expos. But this, something about the professionalism, the seriousness struck me, was palpable. I wanted to understand the meaning of what I'd just seen, what was being said by it. Though, even if I could not grasp that in that very moment, I could at least appreciate the artistry of that small piece of theater, the craft behind it. The crowd was dispersing. I checked my watch and realized I only had an hour to walk back to town. Perhaps for the better. Though I was buzzing with questions, I didn't want to bother this man right after he'd performed. Though, as I turned to go, a whistle blew in my head. 10 minimum, that other man had said. 10 minimum. He must have meant that the show was pay what you can. I jogged over to him, pulled another 20 from my wallet, and held it out. I would have given more if I had it. The man looked confused. Was I wrong? Had I given offense? Or worse, did I look like a rube? But after a moment, he took the money with a wordless mumble and tucked it safely into the strongbox. I was distracted the rest of that day, trying to crystallize in my mind what I'd seen off the side of that dusty road. No trouble for the show, though. That's why we rehearse. The harmonies and step ball chains were memorized by rote, freeing me to think about higher things. The show ended, and we came out for curtain call. Bowed. People assembled clapped, or at least those who weren't already heading for the exits, jonesing to get back to their lucky slot machine. And it all felt hollow. Even more so than usual. What had I even just conveyed? What had the audience received? Whether entertaining, edifying, or electrifying? But nothing. Not compared to what I'd just seen, which, well, I still hadn't struck onto exactly what it was, but I knew it was something important. Some of the cast went out for drinks, but I just couldn't stomach it that night. Listening to the same old conversations, Melissa Beaudreau going on about the altos, or everyone cooing over the latest schlock off-Broadway, watching people flaunt their cheating on their out-of-town partners with each other, while the rest of us ignored it because it'd be bad career politics to make mention. Went to my room instead, making my way through the blinding, deafening casino, and poured myself a glass of cheap, dry red. Phoned my husband, and tried to talk through it all with him. He put it down his throat? He stopped me to confirm in the middle of the story. Yeah. Weird? Weird. You don't think so? He asked. No, I told him. It was performance art. It was the whole point. He didn't think it was art? Well, it's not exactly the same thing you do, came the reply. Yeah, and that's my point. I sighed. It's difficult having these conversations sometimes. Deflating. My husband's a normal, you know, consulting 9 to 5. So half the time it feels like he just sees the glitter of the job, and the other half he's of the mindset that all work is unsatisfying anyway. Or, that's not fair. It just feels that way sometimes. We moved on to his day, and after that I told him I loved him and that I'd call tomorrow. I poured a second glass of wine and just tried to think. For the first time in a long time, excited to do so. Let my covers gulp me up as I went to bed, staring up at the ceiling and seeing kaleidoscope 8 balls, until the world went black. Next day, down to breakfast, making my way through the casino again to get to the buffet. It looked and sounded no different than the night before. Nothing changed but the staff. Many of the guests still glued to the same seats they'd been in 12 hours earlier. Another matinee, bows, back to the dressing room, frantically wiping off makeup and rinsing pomade for my hair. Grabbed my jacket and dashed out without a word to anyone. And I was back on that side road. The white canopy, that temple I'd found, growing with each step. This time I gave 50, duly noted in that yellow scratch pad. For some accounting purpose, I assumed, before it went into the healthy-looking strongbox. It seemed I'd made it just in time, with the man gazing across the crowd as I made my way to the front. This time I did not look away, not for a moment. I wanted to meet that gaze, trying to find some truth behind his eyes. But they were elusive. In some respects, dead, and in others, sparkling with life. A sick pang of jealousy hit my stomach, seeing these eyes that could somehow both convey and hide so much. The tilt, the prep, down, down, and stop, wiggling once, twice, and then up again. Sheer, simple elegance. And again, so little ego and pomp to the whole thing. A nod from him, and a nod back from us. I found myself joining automatically. Again, I want to stress, this is not the kind of thing that I would seek out normally, back in the city. Performance art, interpretive dance, the avant-garde. I did not hate these things, but I had little patience for them. Even less so, art and theater dripping with self-aggrandizement, cloying in its need to show you how thoughtful it was. Art that makes you loathe yourself for feeling like you lack ambition, and is in turn loathsome because it makes you feel that. But this was not that. Either of those things. The gears were turning in my head, and it occurred to me that maybe I wasn't supposed to understand. Maybe this work did not demand my understanding, but simply my attention. To stand there, just be in the presence of, and just feel the taste of metal on my tongue. Maybe. Maybe. But there was still something I was missing. The next few days were a blur, and as they went on, a dread came over me. You see, by end of week, we'd be shipping out to the next leg of our tour. This place, that roadside tent, I might never see them again after that. It shouldn't have mattered, truly. But I felt pressure. That knowledge made me irritable. My work suffered those couple of days, as did my relations, which, again, feels absurd. That a few days, just 1 week really, should feel so weighty and cast such a pall. But that's how it felt. And that short spiral was contoured by routine. Matinee, then sprinting to the side road as quickly as the addicts in our own audience ran back to the casino, handing over hard-earned money, watching it go into a cash box that seemed to grow fatter every day. Maybe they had another showing in the morning I didn't know about. Still, not quite getting it, and each time that ball came back up, feeling that dull ache of disappointment. But excitement coursing through me as well, sure that I'd get it next time. It was our last evening at the hotel, and I was in my room, sitting on the bed, staring at the wall. After I'd missed an entrance and completely fucked up 2 numbers during that evening's show, the stage manager had pulled me aside to check in. I think it was more out of concern for my well-being, but I can't be sure. Everything she'd said had been muffled to me. Underwater. Someone from the cast had knocked at my door earlier, asking if I needed anything. But I didn't reply. I hadn't called home in 2 days, and had dozens of unread texts from my husband. but I just stared at the wall until my eyes eventually fell down to my left side, where in my hand I held an 8-ball, fresh out of its packaging. I'd purchased a set from the town's department store that very day. Because theory only gets you so far. And the greatest and most complete way to understand is to do. I'd seen it enough times, surely. This was necessary. Surely. I stood, shuffled nervously to find the right placement, tilted my head back. A deep breath, a long exhale, trying to rein in my sympathetic nervous system. I opened my mouth, lowered the tongue, raised the palate best I could. The ball was cool. I'd never even considered that. The temperature of the ball, that particular sensation in context. But it warmed slightly as my hot breath formed moisture on its surface. Closer. Closer. A faltering moment as the sick click of my teeth against the ball's resin echoed like a gunshot inside the chamber of my mouth. My tongue squirmed, brushed up against it to taste the mummification of its packing plastic and cardboard. But still, I pushed. So close now. My mouth all the way around it. The glossy lettering of that 8 teasing at my esophagus. And suddenly, my body simply said, no. My throat produced a gagging sound I never thought it capable of, and turned every one of its muscles to the task of ejecting that foreign object. But at the same time, that tension closed my mouth somewhat, and the 8-ball caught on my teeth again, scraping resin, leading to a second and even more disturbing gag. Panic. Suffocation. Desperation. Another few dry, heavy heaves. Heaves that felt like they'd rip my body in half. And it was out, dribbling from my open mouth, tears and snot pouring freely, my whole throat feeling like an open wound as I crawled on hands and knees to the bathroom to spit up bile for the next 10 minutes. Eventually rolling onto the cold tile floor, weeping just to be alive, and passing out. That couldn't have been what it was like for him. That every single time? Obviously, he'd mastered the mechanics more than I could hope to in such a short time. But was there always that fear? That sense of bodily rejection? Where was the electricity? These thoughts swirled through my mind in uneasy dreams. And then it hit me. It was so obvious. How could you ever call what I had just tried alone in my room a performance? A performance requires an audience. My eyes shot open. I lurched up, wiping the crust from around my mouth, the inside of it still burning, still so sore. What time was it? No, that didn't matter. My internal clock told me it was exactly the right time. I ran back into the main room and snatched the spit-covered 8 off the floor. Ran out the door, past concerned-looking cleaners. Ran through the casino, spying all those same miserable lifers basking in the glow, throwing their money away to the tune of machine music. Ran out into the open air, soiled clothes and crazed eyes in plain view under the sun. There was time. There was still time before we had to load onto the bus and leave this place. And even if there wasn't time, it didn't matter. There was an audience waiting for me. People of taste, of discernment, people who appreciated this piece for what it was and could help me unlock its meaning. And then, I would be one of those people. You know the ones. People who made art that was important. I never thought I'd wanted it. Never thought I'd needed it. But there, then, right at that precipice, I realized that I did need it. My pace quickened down the side road. There it was, that white tent, the crowd, and something else. What was that? That distant sound coming off the wind, growing louder as the tent grew closer. Laughter. A self-satisfied laughter. Barely 50 yards off now, and I could see that the people under that tent were not in their usual tight formation, that curve they always formed around the imaginary proscenium. They were loose, lively, not respectfully, stoically silent as they always had been, but talking amongst their peers or chuckling to themselves. And every set of hands and eyes were preoccupied with the same busy work as they did. The ticket taker, the man in the chair, was in his usual spot, but he was now doubled over, head in his hands, shaking as little sobs bubbled up over the murmur of the crowd. Lying on the ground by his chair, that strong box sat upturned and empty. Its contents, I realized as my eyes rose again, divided and being carefully counted by everyone else present. This wasn't right. None of this was right. The eight ball slid from my hand onto the dirt as I barreled through to the other side of the crowd, so quickly that I practically tripped as I broke through them. Tripped over the body lying on the ground. A tall body, wearing dull slacks and a chambray shirt, with thinning hair and a wind-scarred face, with broad shoulders and a back the world would beat no longer, with a roughly 57 millimeter in diameter bulge protruding from his throat, looking up at the sky with dead eyes. Needless to say, my mind in that moment emptied of such words as art, theater, cerebral. I slowly drifted back to the dead man's kin to comfort, to ask what had happened. I do not know. But he was inconsolable, still folded over, and I only now noticed that small yellow notebook having tumbled from his chest pocket to the ground. Compelled to, I reached down and grabbed it, leafed through the pages. There were dates, numbers, names, or sometimes nicknames. Odds. My guts twisted sickly as curiosity forced me to turn back several days. To the first day, I'd stumbled onto this, whatever you wanted to call it. And sure enough, there at the bottom of the page, City Boy, $10. The next page, City Boy, $50. No entry for me today, though. I hadn't made it in time to place my bet. And despite myself, looking out at that crowd, not a savvy, thoughtful audience like I'd thought them, us to be, looking out at them, counting their winnings, made my stomach sink even more. I slowly staggered back to town after that, cleaned myself up, ate something, and packed myself onto that bus to leave that place forever. I'd finally found understanding, if not satisfaction. Understanding of that electric excitement that would pass through my mind and around my tongue, and a newfound compassion and empathy for all those small-town people so horribly and happily addicted to the casino's neon smile. We finished the tour. I made my apologies where needed and focused solely on the work. It was the only way for me to make it through. But I don't take those kinds of contracts anymore. Not because I don't respect them, but because I don't trust myself to be in those kinds of places. That's not to say that I'm picky. I try to keep an open mind. Because satisfaction can be found in simple work. and just because something feels important does not mean it's risen above desperation. Look at the work for what it is, and not just the glitter of it. The Wrong Station is made possible with the generous support of our listeners on Patreon. Visit today at patreon.com/thewrongstation. You can also support us by leaving a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever it is you tune into the show. This week's episode, Roadside Attraction, was written and performed by Anthony Botello. Thank you to Karen Croft, Moises Lopez, Mari Nilsson, Kevin, Vanessa Marquand, Laura Wren, and Zach1886. And a very special thanks to Sarah Jenkins Fleming, Alex L., and Melissa Beaudreau for helping us keep the lights, well, off. The Wrong Station is co-produced by Alexander Saxton, Anthony Botello, and Jacob Duarte Spiel, with music composed and performed by Alan Citrin and arranged for the viola and performed by Viola Schmidt. You can follow The Wrong Station on social media, at The Wrong Station, and email us at thewrongstation@gmail.com. And until next time, thank you for listening.